Audio Scholar presents The Nature of Space and Time by Stephen Hawking. Executive producer is Lawrence Bauman. Your reader is Julian Lopez Morilla. Stephen Hawking is Lucasian Professor of Mathematics at the University of Cambridge and author of A Brief History of Time and other works. This selection from Princeton University Press is published in the book The Nature of Space and Time, the Isaac Newton Institute Series of Lectures by Stephen Hawking and Roger Penrose. And now, The Nature of Space and Time by Stephen Hawking. Lecture 1, Classical Theory. There is a short article by Richard Feynman describing his experiences at a conference on general relativity. I think it was the Warsaw Conference in 1962. It commented very unfavorably on the general competence of the people there and the relevance of what they were doing. That general relativity soon acquired a much better reputation and more interest is in considerable measure due to Roger Penrose's work. Up to then, general relativity had been formulated as a messy set of partial differential equations in a single coordinate system. People were so pleased when they found a solution that they didn't care that it probably had no physical significance. However, Roger brought in modern concepts like spinors and global methods. He was the first to show that one could discover general properties without solving the equations exactly. It was his first singularity theorem that introduced me to the study of causal structure and inspired my classical work on singularities and black holes. I think Roger and I pretty much agree on the classical work. However, we differ in our approach to quantum gravity and indeed to quantum theory itself. Although I'm regarded as a dangerous radical by particle physicists for proposing that there may be loss of quantum coherence, I'm definitely a conservative compared to Roger. I take the positivist viewpoint that a physical theory is just a mathematical model and that it is meaningless to ask whether it corresponds to reality. All that one can ask is that its predictions should be in agreement with observation. I think Roger is a Platonist at heart, but he must answer for himself. Although there have been suggestions that space-time may have a discrete structure, I see no reason to abandon the continuum theories that have been so successful. General relativity is a beautiful theory that agrees with every observation that has been made. It may be only a low-energy approximation to some more fundamental theory, like string theory, but I think string theory has been oversold. First of all, it is not clear that general relativity, when combined with various other fields in a supergravity theory, cannot give a sensible quantum theory. Reports of the death of supergravity are exaggerations. One year everyone believed that supergravity was finite. The next year the fashion changed and everyone said that supergravity was bound to have divergences, even though none had actually been found. My second reason for not discussing string theory is that it has not made any testable predictions. By contrast, the straightforward application of quantum theory to general relativity, which I will be talking about, has already made two testable predictions. One of these predictions, the development of small perturbations during inflation, seems to be confirmed by recent observations of fluctuations in the microwave background. The other prediction, that black holes should radiate thermally, is testable in principle. All we have to do is find a primordial black hole. Unfortunately, there don't seem to be many around in this neck of the woods. If there had been, we would know how to quantize gravity. Neither of these predictions will be changed, even if string theory is the ultimate theory of nature. But string theory, at least at its current state of development, is quite incapable of making these predictions except by appealing to general relativity as the low-energy effective theory. I suspect this may always be the case, and that there may not be any observable predictions of string theory that cannot also be predicted from general relativity or supergravity. If this is true, it raises the question of whether string theory is a genuine scientific theory. Is mathematical beauty and completeness enough in the absence of distinctive observationally tested predictions? Not that string theory in its present form is either beautiful or complete. For these reasons, I shall talk about general relativity in these lectures. I shall concentrate on two areas where gravity seems to lead to features that are completely different from other field theories. The first is the idea that gravity should cause space-time to have a beginning and maybe an end. The second is the discovery that there seems to be intrinsic gravitational entropy that is not the result of coarse graining. Some people have claimed that these predictions are only artifacts of the semi-classical approximation. They say that string theory, the true quantum theory of gravity, will smear out the singularities and will introduce correlations in the radiation from black holes so that it is only approximately thermal in the coarse-grained sense. It would be rather boring if this were the case. Gravity would be just like any other field. But I believe it is distinctly different because it shapes the arena in which it acts, unlike other fields which act in a fixed space-time background. It is this that leads to the possibility of time having a beginning. It also leads to regions of the universe that one can't observe, which in turn gives rise to the concept of gravitational entropy as a measure of what we can't know. Theorems predict singularities in two situations. One is in the future, in the gravitational collapse of stars and other massive bodies. Such singularities would be an end of time, at least for particles moving on the incomplete geodesics. The other situation in which singularities are predicted is in the past, at the beginning of the present expansion of the universe. This led to the abandonment of attempts, mainly by the Russians, to argue that there was a previous contracting phase and a non-singular bounce into expansion. Instead, almost everyone now believes that the universe and time itself had a beginning at the Big Bang. This is a discovery far more important than a few miscellaneous unstable particles, but not one that has been so well recognized by Nobel Prizes. The prediction of singularities means that classical general relativity is not a complete theory. Because the singular points have to be cut out of the space-time manifold, one cannot define the field equations there and cannot predict what will come out of a singularity. With the singularity in the past, the only way to deal with this problem seems to be to appeal to quantum gravity. I shall return to this in my third lecture. But the singularities that are predicted in the future seem to have a property that Penrose has called cosmic censorship. That is, they conveniently occur in places like black holes that are hidden from external observers. So any breakdown of predictability that may occur at these singularities won't affect what happens in the outside world, at least not according to classical theory. However, as I shall show in my next lecture, there is unpredictability in the quantum theory. This is related to the fact that gravitational fields can have intrinsic entropy that is not just the result of coarse graining. Gravitational entropy and the fact that time has a beginning and may have an end are the two themes of my lectures because they are the ways in which gravity is distinctly different from other physical fields. The fact that gravity has a quantity that behaves like entropy was first noticed in the purely classical theory. It depends on Penrose's cosmic censorship conjecture. This is unproved, but it is believed to be true for suitably general initial data and equations of state. I shall use a weak form of cosmic censorship. One makes the approximation of treating the region around a collapsing star as asymptotically flat. Then, as Penrose showed, one can conformally embed the space-time manifold in a manifold with boundary. The boundary will be a null surface and will consist of two components, future and past, null infinity. I shall say that weak cosmic censorship holds if two conditions are satisfied. First, it is assumed that observers far from the collapse live to an old age and are not wiped out by a thunderbolt singularity sent out from a collapsing star. Second, it is assumed that the past is globally hyperbolic. This means there are no naked singularities that can be seen from large distances. Penrose has a stronger form of cosmic censorship, which assumes that the whole space-time is globally hyperbolic. But the weak form will suffice for my purposes. If weak cosmic censorship holds, the singularities that are predicted to occur in gravitational collapse can't be visible. This means that there must be a region of space-time that is not in the past. This region is said to be a black hole because no light or anything else can escape from it to infinity. The boundary of the black hole region is called the event horizon. because it is also the boundary of the past, the event horizon will be generated by null geodesic segments that may have past endpoints but don't have any future endpoints. It then follows that if the weak energy condition holds, the generators of the horizon can't be converging, for if they were, they would intersect each other within a finite distance. This implies that the area of a cross-section of the event horizon can never decrease with time and in general will increase. Moreover, if two black holes collide and merge together, the area of the final black hole will be greater than the sum of the areas of the original black holes. This is very similar to the behavior of entropy according to the second law of thermodynamics. Entropy can never decrease, and the entropy of a total system is greater than the sum of its constituent parts. The similarity with thermodynamics is increased by what is called the first law of black hole mechanics. This relates the change in mass of a black hole to the change in the area of the event horizon and the change in its angular momentum and electric charge. One can compare this to the first law of thermodynamics, which gives the change in internal energy in terms of the change in entropy and the external work done on the system. One sees that if the area of the event horizon is analogous to entropy, then the quantity analogous to temperature is what is called the surface gravity of the black hole. This is a measure of the strength of the gravitational field on the event horizon. The similarity with thermodynamics is further increased by the so-called zeroth law of black hole mechanics. The surface gravity is the same everywhere on the event horizon of a time-independent black hole. Encouraged by these similarities, Bekenstein proposed that some multiple of the area of the event horizon actually was the entropy of a black hole. He suggested a generalized second law. The sum of this black hole entropy and the entropy of matter outside black holes would never decrease. However, this proposal was not consistent. If black holes have an entropy proportional to horizon area, they should also have a non-zero temperature proportional to surface gravity. Consider a black hole that is in contact with thermal radiation at a temperature lower than the black hole temperature. The black hole will absorb some of the radiation, but won't be able to send anything out, because according to classical theory, nothing can get out of a black hole. One thus has heat flow from the low-temperature thermal radiation to the higher-temperature black hole. This would violate the generalized second law, because the loss of entropy from the thermal radiation would be greater than the increase in black hole entropy. However, as we shall see in my next lecture, consistency was restored when it was discovered that black holes are sending out radiation that was exactly thermal. This is too beautiful a result to be a coincidence or just an approximation. So it seems that black holes really do have intrinsic gravitational entropy. As I shall show, this is related to the non-trivial topology of a black hole. The intrinsic entropy means that gravity introduces an extra level of unpredictability over and above the uncertainty usually associated with quantum theory. So Einstein was wrong when he said, God does not play dice. Consideration of black holes suggests not only that God does play dice, but that he sometimes confuses us by throwing them where they can't be seen.